Welcome to New Books in World Music, devoted to discussions with scholars of world music and ethnomusicology. I'm your host, Garrett Field, and today I'm talking with Matt Rahim from the University of Minnesota about his new book, Musicking Bodies, Gesture and Voice in Hindustani Music. This book breaks new ground in scholarship not only about North Indian classical music, but also about the role of the body and gesture in music. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks. Really happy to be here, Garrett.
So could you start us off by telling us about your background? What brought you to ethnomusicology and the study of Hindustani music?
I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts and had the good fortune of living next door to somebody who was a fairly earnest student of the sitar. And he asked me if I would bring my recording equipment over and record him one day. And so sitting there with my headphones on, I was kind of forced to listen for, 30, 40 minutes as he very slowly elaborated a rag, a North Indian rag. And I was very impressed. I'd never listened carefully to sitar before. Certainly had heard it as a kind of sound effect in movies and commercials and whatnot. But for a 16-year-old kid, sitting there and sort of out of practical necessity, being forced to listen very closely to something for 30 or 40 minutes was kind of a revelation for me. And so I got really interested in Indian music, and my neighbor was very supportive, and he gave me a bunch of his records. And then when I went to college, I ended up at Wesleyan, which is, as you know, a wonderful place for world music. Mm-hmm. And I found a teacher there and got my ears open to all different kinds of music, including, madrigal and motets and the grand Western art music tradition that I had never really had much exposure to. So after that, I got shipped off to India on a grant right after college, and spent a year there studying very intensely, studying vocal music with Vikas Kashalkar. And after that, I was more or less hooked. I knew this was something I wanted to devote all of my practicing time to. And ended up going back just about yearly from then till now to continue my instruction and training. And it was through that I got interested in ethnomusicology, through the sort of clashes between what you expect and what you see. Gradually what started out as a fairly nerdy interest in, modal structure and learning to sing well, it turned into an interest in, a scholarly interest in Indian music. And at that time, I was teaching high school in Berkeley, California, for a living. And ended up applying to grad school in Berkeley because Bonnie Wade, who'd written, this really huge, important book about the exact genre of music I was studying, was teaching right up the street. Mm. So it was all kind of serendipitous and fell together very nicely. And Berkeley was where I had my scholarly training. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's great. Yeah. So this book, Musicking Bodies, it's about the relationship between gesture and voice in North Indian classical music. And so you get to Berkeley and you're studying with Bonnie Wade, the author of a lot of works on khyal, the genre of Hindustani music that that you are practicing and performing and developing a scholarly interest about. And so what inspired you to study gesture in North Indian classical music?
Well, I had a wonderful teacher at Wesleyan named John Barlow, who was kind of a specialist in medieval music. And he was convinced that there was some deep connection between the earliest notations of Gregorian chant and various movements of the hand and various movements of breath and other sorts of more intangible movements. He had a fairly well elaborated and kind of esoteric theory of how all these things fit together.
Yeah, in the book, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's a remarkable guy. He's sort of a you know, an occult theorist in the sense that he doesn't fit into any musicological discipline very neatly. Hmm. But, you know, studying with him, that was just sort of like an interesting thing for me. It was kind of intellectual. But then when I got to India and started sitting with teachers there, I started noticing, you know, everybody moves their hands as they sing. And not only that, but by attending to what my teacher's hands were doing and allowing my hands to move as I sang, I found I could learn much more easily. I had a much clearer grasp of what was going on melodically, the phrasing, the weight, you know, the vazan, they say, you know, landing on a note with particular weight, building melodic shapes. All of these things kind of sprang to life in a way that they don't if you think that music is only sound. And so that started getting me thinking maybe there was something to this, but, you know, at least when I first was starting to learn, I still wasn't really thinking I would ever go to school to study this or, you know, make any sort of serious disciplined inquiry into it.
Right.
So, and then when I got to Berkeley, I got sort of varying degrees of support at first. You know, some people were super supportive and thought it was a wonderful idea to figure out what's going on with people's hands, and other people then and now thought it was. Well, you know, a crackpot idea. It was crazy.
And I should say the book opens with a very a memorable narrative about how that kind of opinions about gesture. And I thought it was a beautiful way of beginning opening the book like that, beginning with someone's opinion about how gesture was kind of peripheral to the overall experience of Hindustani music.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. This was one of those kind of discouraging moments in fieldwork. I'm sure you've had them too, Garrett, where
the
people that you're hoping will tell you the most about what you're studying actually turn around and tell you you're looking at the wrong things. And it turned out that the terms, and, you know, once I started paying attention to the terms in which people were making these claims, it started actually telling me a whole lot about my project, because it turns out one of the very interesting things about gesture is the way that it's kind of systematically not talked about, you know, systematically occluded or cast shadows upon. And especially in the course of the 20th century, the ways that the voice has been constructed as a kind of ghostly, immaterial phantom of pure subjectivity floating above the body, this turns out to be a very interesting and important thing.
Yes, and
Yeah.
So in your first chapter, you really led me into something I wanted to ask you. Is you write about the voice and the body and how they came to be considered separate entities in Indian classical music. So can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is any history of gesture is bound to be very sketchy, because the earliest films that we have of people singing are, you know, maybe the 20s and 30s. And so, you know, a history of gesture is not going to tell you something like how were people moving their hands in Akbar's court, you know, how were people moving their hands 300 years ago. But there is a great deal you can learn about what people seem to say and think about gesture 300 or 400 years ago. And it's clear that people have been saying that gesture is terrible since at least the middle of the 13th century. In other words, people have been saying that singers should move as little as possible since roughly that time. And so there's this major treatise of the mid-13th century called the Sangeeta Ratnakar. And in there, you find this list of bad things that singers do, and among them, predictably enough, is moving your hands too much. Hmm. And when I say this is an influential treatise, I mean there were treatises in the coming centuries that would just borrow this list and reproduce it exactly, just sort of boilerplate. Here are the good things the singer does, here are the bad things the singer does. And this was reproduced almost verbatim, actually, in a whole series of treatises after that. So, I mean, it's nothing new that people think that, that gesture, at least excessive gesture, could be a bad idea. But what is new in the 20th century is kind of this new separation, a very radical separation of singers and dancers as a matter of social organization. Mm-hmm. And also a whole series of kind of intellectual currents that articulated in a kind of spiritualization of the voice and a despiritualization of the body. There are a lot of factors here. In the first main chapter in the book gets into these, but things like the development of the science of voice production, for example, in the 19th century, this is something Kathy Bergeron has written beautifully about in her book Voice Lessons, and treating the voice as something that's merely produced by the larynx and not by the rest of the body, just sort of a mechanical course of production that happens in this one tiny little organ. You know, there's this wonderful story about Rabindranath Tagore's early tutoring, where his British tutor brings him a human larynx wrapped in towels to one of his lessons and says, here's the marvelous gift of the creator, he's given us voices, and here's what the voice looks like. And he opens it up, and you imagine little Rabindranath looking at this, and he says in his memoirs, I couldn't believe that something as big as the voice would be caused by something so small. I'd always thought that the whole man spoke. However great this thing may be, isn't the whole man speaking even better? So, there's some ways in which these scientific currents chafed against already well-established notions of what the voice was and where it came from. But it seems within a few decades, the kind of science of the voice, scientific linguistics that treats words entirely separate from their method of performance, methods of music theoretic analysis that abstract voices from performances, where you're left with a kind of abstraction of a rag that has nothing to do with any particularities of performance. And the major music theoretic project of the 20th century, Vishnu Narayan Bhatkhande, he went around and he recorded notated the performances of dozens and dozens of great masters, and more or less wrote them out of the story and just kind of abstracted from these, what can we learn in general about how this raga is sung or this raga is sung. So all of these theoretical and scientific and humanistic intellectual occurrence, I think, all kind of came together in making gesture seem as though it's something kind of extraneous. The body's something kind of extraneous. And certainly what nationalists were concerned about and music reformers were concerned about was a kind of purity of voice, a purity of tradition that wasn't held back by the confusing particularities of individual bodies, individual styles, and certainly not of gesture.
Hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating. You also you mentioned also about the phonograph and the way that in connection also to all these other currents, how in the phonograph the voice is separated from the body, and it's the 20th century. There's so many changes, and in the first chapter, after you've set out and explored this history of moving and singing in India, we begin in the second chapter to look at specific musical examples, and you present the reader with very beautiful images of singers gesturing in particular ways, and you have the notation right underneath, which explores this relationship between music and gesture. And so the first thing I'd like to ask you is, and you talk about this a little bit in your appendix, about your video data, is can you tell us a little bit about the methodologies that you have used for this research project?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, most of it looked like me just going in there and setting up a video camera and then sitting with singers. And one important thing is the video camera is typically just trained on the singer that I'm working with at the time, which is already kind of a limitation, right? It already this is already something that ethnomusicologists are not supposed to do, right? We're supposed to be thinking about these social interactions and kind of looking beyond the great individuals, and that is, you know, in some ways you do lose that by training the camera on one person. But eventually, you know, as the book progresses and as my project progressed, I began to see individual bodies as sites for social webs of influence, webs of training that stretch through time and space, and you start to see individual bodies as more than just individuals.
Right.
In other words, it's true that there's only two arms, two legs, one head in the picture, but you see this not as just like a you know, a radically autonomous being, but a being that owes its entire musicality, its all of its ways of voicing and being and moving, to years of training and with usually several teachers, hundreds of concerts they'd attended, and all of these subtle influences. And singers are perfectly aware of this and love to talk about their influences, love to talk about their relationships with their gurus. I mean, if you get me talking about my relationships with my gurus, I go on all day about it. So this is something a little bit deceptive. You know, most of my video data is what appears to be a single body on the screen. But when you start looking at these as sites of social processes, you realize they're much more than individuals.
That's fascinating, that really becomes clear, especially in the chapters on the musicking body and the paramparic bodies. But before we go into that into detail, I wanted to talk a little bit about you talk about the contingent links, what you say is the contingent links between vocalization and gesture. So can you speak a little bit about these contingent links between vocalization and gesture?
Sure, yeah. So I'll give you an example. The first example in the book is a singer who's singing a series of descending phrases, and the da da, these sorts of phrases over and over. And as they sing these phrases, their hands are kind of tracing these descending arcs. You know, you can picture like sort of like rainbows or something, or water spilling out of a glass. And you know, many people who were kind of casually looking at the relationship between voice and gesture in the early part of the 20th century without the benefit of lots of video data would say something quite reasonable like, well, his voice is going down and his hand is going down, so his hand is tracing the voice. You know, his hand is sort of following along, or it's a kind of metaphor for what the voice is doing. And, you know, there are cases like this. If you just look at, you know, a few seconds here or there, short clips, it really does seem to work. You know, a link like that does seem to work out.
Right.
But as you start looking at more cases, you realize that, you know, maybe a singer will do that for 5 seconds or 10 seconds, and then they'll switch to a new idea, and they'll no longer just be moving up and down as their voice moves up and down. Now, next, they're using some sort of, cylindrical coordinate system, and then you start thinking, okay, this is a different link. And then a few minutes later, they seem to be using left and right as a map for up and down. And then you start noticing them gripping things and pulling things and stretching things. And you realize that the whatever links there might be here only obtain for fairly limited stretches of time, you know, usually for the length of the development of one melodic idea. Later in the book, this gives way to a different view. It just starts becoming kind of unsustainable to think of the voice and the hands as being two separate things. But certainly in this chapter, to kind of build the case that there's some connection and yet it's also contingent, all of the analyses are just as you said. You know, you have the as though they were different instruments, you know, a gestural transcription, and then right below it, a vocal transcription.
Right, and then you finished chapter two saying that voice and gesture, they're parallel aspects of melody, and you talk about two ideas, melody as motion and melody as tone. So what do you mean by these distinctions?
Well, these are two models that are fairly common sense, even to, you know, even to non-musicians, and they're certainly common sense to Indian musicians. So there's one time-honored way of analyzing melody, where you think of a melodic process as being a sequence of items, you know, like beads on a string. So da. you can think of that as sadha, two notes, right? Two items. Or sadha re sa, four notes. Sadha re sa, But on the other hand, you can also think of that as motion. You can think of that as a kind of curvaceous swooping phrase where you end up back where you started. You know, like those birds, I think they're called house finches, that start out on a telephone wire, fly down very quickly, and then return right where they were a moment ago. Mm. So both of these are fairly common sense, and we talk about melodies ascending. We talk about melodies kind of swimming around aimlessly, returning to where they were before, exploring new territory. This is a perfectly reasonable frame to speak about melody in. And the point I'm trying to make in that chapter is that it seems at first as though notes are kind of like a hard-nosed, objective account of what's happening. Right. Whereas, you know, motion is kind of fanciful or poetic. Well, actually, they're both fairly fanciful. They're both fairly poetic. And those are both fairly verifiable ways of describing what's going on, and very useful ways. So there are some situations where you really do want your student to understand a sequence of stopping points. And when you do, you're going to give them a sequence of notes. And there are other occasions when the student might be getting the notes right, but they're not getting the shape of a phrase right. They're not getting the weight, the correct flow, like the, you know, it sounds like they're stopping someplace too long, whereas they should just be touching and pushing off or something. And in those situations, you really want to be talking about motion. Now, of course, moving your hands is a very apt way of getting across these ideas about melodic motion. Mm. And the fact that the voice and the hand are so tightly coordinated, you know, it's not as though the hand is following after the voice. The two are happening in precisely co-timed ways. This suggests that a lot of what's going on as you're singing, and especially when you're improvising, is a process of motion, thinking in motion. And singers say this all the time. They say, oh, if I'm singing something really elaborate, or if I'm singing, you know, when I'm in the course of improvising something, I'm not thinking note by note by note. I'm not just right. thinking, okay, first sa, then re, and then I'm going to go ma, and then ga, and then pa. It's rather the whole thing is kind of contained in a continuous swooping kind of goal-oriented action. And so for all of those reasons, I think it's important to keep both of those models of melody in mind. And once you keep them both in mind, it doesn't seem so strange at all that you would move your hands while you sing.
And that's what's nice about the book, is that its theory is really rooted in practice. And I think that offers us a new perspective. And so the third chapter of your book, it's about ragas as spaces. And I think it's amazing how you put that into words. I have studied a South Indian classical music, and I have experienced this. And so how is seeing ragas as space different from how ragas are normally conceptualized?
Well, there's, you know, most of the music theory about Indian music is about raga. And most of that music theory proceeds in terms of note sequences. So to go back to those two models before, usually when people talk about rag, they're talking about the correct grammatical sequences of notes that make one rag distinct from another. Mm. So particularly in Hindustani music, where you have sometimes 10, 12, 15 rags that have the same scale, the way that people typically resort to differentiating between them is by talking about appropriate and inappropriate note sequences. This is very easy to write down in a book. It's very easy to think of. It's very easy to transcribe. It seems very precise. And yet it also misses something. And every musician will acknowledge that this way of thinking of rags as grammar misses something quite crucial about the knowledge that musicians have about rags. Certainly the way that you learn a rag does not proceed from grammatical rules to melodic utterances any more than learning your native language proceeds from learning a set of grammatical rules to a set of grammatical utterances.
Yeah, it's interesting because those things, like, you... on the surface, it looks like those things would come first because when we kind of relearn them, we study them first. But really, it's like you say, like it's the opposite.
Yeah, and there's and this is not in any way to demean grammatical approaches to rag. I think it's fascinating as music theory. You know, it's amazing how much there is to say about these grammatical differences. And yet, when you learn a rag from a teacher over a good deal of time, with the end in mind that you're going to be improvising freely in this rag and convincingly and conveying the feeling of this rag, you almost invariably fall into a way of speaking that has to do with movement in a space, exploring what are called jaga, or you know, the what's literally the places or the spaces within a rag, talking about modes of ascent, paths, leaping over notes, resting on a place, putting yourself down on a place. There's a rich set of music theoretic terms that are kind of informal that speak very naturally as though a rag is the space that you learn to move in. So if we're thinking as though a melody is made of discrete notes, then we're liable to speak about grammar. If we're thinking that melody is motion, then we're liable to speak about raga as being a space for that motion. And the differences between rags as being not so much, you know, do's and don'ts, but rather kind of the affordances for motion that different spaces provide.
Right. So one example that you focus on is what you call the Ramkali shift. So different gestures accompanied this phrase and similar phrases in the rag Bhairav. Is that correct, or how did that, how does that sound, that Ramkali shift?
Well, so Ramkali is very similar to another rag called Bhairav, and music theorists disagree about what precisely the relationship is. But one way of thinking about the difference is that Ramkali behaves like Bhairav just about all the time, except for the introduction of these couple other accidental notes. So when you're in Bhairav, you know, sa ga ma pa ma ga re sa sa ni sa ga ma pa ga ma dha pa. So it's like, you know, it has a flat second and a flat sixth. In Ramkali, in addition to having this space to move in, there's this other special kind of subspace centered around pa, where you bring the ma, I'm sorry, the fifth scale degree, where you bring the fourth scale degree a little bit higher. Pa, ma, pa, da, ni, da, pa. And then you go back to your other patterns of motion. Pa, ga, di, sa, sa, ga, ma, pa, ga, ma, pa, da, pa. And then here's the Ramkali specialty. Pa, ma, pa, da, ni, da, pa, ga, ma, di, sa. So the interesting thing about the analysis I gave in the book, and not everybody does this, but in this one lovely performance by Girija Devi, she's every time she goes into this Ramkali shift, this special melodic subspace, her hands also are exploring in a separate subspace. So ordinarily she's kind of doing translational motion, you know, back and forth. She's got a wide kind of rectangular space she's moving in. But for the Ramkali shift, this kind of curving loop back around the fifth scale degree, she starts moving her hands in a kind of small looping spherical motion in front of her abdomen, a much smaller space, and using two hands, whereas for the rest of it she uses one. She it's a relatively tight and tense and kind of curvaceous space, whereas the other space is more linear and involving larger swoops. So the point here is simply that even within these spaces, there are sometimes very discrete and salient subspaces, both gesturally and vocally.
Yeah, it's really a great example. I think it epitomizes the idea of raga as space. And in chapter 4, you devote some thought to a method of improvisation called upaj, where the singer develops short phrases by appending melodic material before and after.
So first of all, I should say upaj can mean a lot of things to different people. It has a kind of literal agricultural meaning, you know, just like a sprouting or a coming up. It can also mean something kind of like occurring to you. And when musicians use it, sometimes they just use it to refer to improvisation, you know, what Carnatic musicians might say, like manodharma, right? Yeah. Like, you know, as opposed to a composition. But it also has a slightly more technical meaning, especially in certain lineages. Upaj means, just as you said, a sort of development of a phrase by, you know, building on to things before it and after it, expanding it, so that what starts as kind of like a seed phrase then grows into something. And, you know, this might be a totally false etymology, but I always remember that as being kind of linked to the sense of upaj as a literal sprouting. So, I mean, the relevance it has for thinking about moving in time, and here, as you can probably tell, by this chapter, we're already starting to move apart from thinking about gesture and voice as two different connected things, and instead starting to think about what it's like to sing, right?
Yeah.
So here we can think about each of these phrases that we're developing as being kind of like an object that we're building. Right. In the example in the book, we're seeing these gestural kind of putting aside of each of these in place, as though we're building like a sequence of these things, like bricks almost. This is, you know, again, it's not that everybody does this, and the examples of the book are not meant to be a kind of like decoder ring, right?
Sure,
for going from, oh, if he's moving his hands like that, he must be doing this. No, rather, I want to say that there are some definite patterns in how singers report it feels to move in singing, both vocally and gesturally. And there are some ways that this is quite apparent from the way that that people are moving as they're singing. So putting down, coming together, putting aside, these things tend to occur at the end of fairly important phrase endings, you know, where you've made a point and now you're done with it. Similarly, at the end of metric cycles, where you've kind of made your point, and often you'll see something like you know, tying a knot or putting down or placing aside or something like that.
That's amazing. So, okay, in chapter 5, you introduce the concept of musicking body, and you have sections devoted to things like pulling, and posture, and grip, and release. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, how do Hindustani musicians use these techniques in the course of improvisation?
Sure, yeah. So it's a verbal form of musicking, which in this case, it mostly just means singing. And so there's nothing terribly fancy about this word, except that it puts the verbness of music over its sort of objectness. And I think when we think about music as something you do rather than a thing out there, right? Oh, let's put some music in the CD player. Let's get some music. Oh, what music do you have? When we think of it as a verb, then a lot of the things I'm trying to bring up in this book about what singers do in the course of performance start making a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And the musicking body is simply a way of getting at a distinction between what it's like when you're in the moment of making music. And here, you know, you can think about what it's like when you pick up your instrument, you have it in your hands, and you've just started moving to play your first note. Mm. Or you sit down, you've just taken your breath to sing your first melodic utterance. And something changes, right? Your postures change. You're sitting in a way you wouldn't sit otherwise. It's certainly for me, my teachers come to mind. My breath changes. My voice changes. In a sense, you become kind of a different person. Mm-hmm. And so this comes to replace the view of, you know, in the earlier chapters where you, for analytic reasons, were making voice and gesture seem like kind of separate things, and we're shining a bright light on gesture as a theme here. By this point, everything that happens to you when you're about to sing, this all becomes one thing. right? It's not like you're singing a few notes and then you're also flapping your hand around and you just happen to be doing those things at the same time.
Right.
But like singing an ascending phrase and having your hand kind of curvaceously move up in the air, this is one thing that you're doing with your lungs, with your, you know, the cat's cradle of muscles in your larynx, with your tongue, with your jaw, with your shoulders, with your hand. It's not like 30 things that you're painstakingly coordinating. This is a single action that you're engaged in. And the body engaged in this action in this way, I'm calling the musicking body, because it takes on certain kinds of characteristics and affinities that it doesn't have when you're just kind of sitting back and, you know, drinking tea or playing cricket or riding your bike or something like that.
Right. And then in the final chapter, we learn about what you call paramparic bodies. And I think we, from what you said in the beginning about how it was interesting, I never had thought about the way that studying an individual could bring criticism about, oh, well, you're only focusing on the individual and not, you know, it's kind of this, that like the individual as the star kind of individual only approach. But you say that thinking about it from the standpoint of paramparic bodies, it's through the individual you see the social fabric or the socialness about the culture. So what inspires you about this idea of the paramparic bodies?
I started thinking about finding a way to talk about how it is that people are able to see teachers and hear teachers in other people's voices. So this became apparent to me pretty soon after getting to India when I started studying with Vikas Kashalkar. And people could tell that I had been studying with Vikas Kashalkar from the way that I moved and the way that I sang. And they would quite explicitly say it. Oh, you're moving your hands like him. When I returned to the U.S. after my first trip there, I gave a concert, and somebody came up to me afterwards who'd seen me sing before, and she said, "The way you sing has changed. You're starting to move like this." And from the way she was moving, impersonating me, I could even see my teacher's habits in that. I could sort of see my teacher in that. So I wanted to find some way to account for this, that whatever the musicking body is, it's not some, you know, autonomous being fully, you know, choosing every single thing it's doing, every vocal utterance, every movement of the hand. All of these things are sort of built out of a repertoire that's available to you. It's not as though you're totally free and flapping around. You learn from usually, you know, 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4. Some people have as many as 8 teachers. But in any case, you're surrounded by all these different ways of musically being, all of these different musicking bodies that have their own traits, their own affinities, and as I eventually come to stress towards the end of the book, their own patterns of virtue. You know, this becomes super important when people talk about what makes a great singer great, when people talk about what makes a great voice great. They typically are not just saying, oh, you know, it's because she has such a pretty voice, or, oh, it's because I really liked how she sang Gamma Danisa Ni. That was really great. That's what I love about her voice. Typically, what you hear is something like, Amir Khan is so patient. You know, he sings with this kind of expansive patience, or Fayaz Khan, like that's, he has such a dignified voice. No one sings like that anymore, with that kind of dignity and weight and confidence. So you hear all the time people are reading ethical dispositions into musicking bodies. And so by the end of the book, this is kind of where I wanted to take things, because in a sense, this is what attracted me to Hindustani music in the first place. Was, you know, when I heard voices that I was attracted to something in there that made me think there's some way about this musical way of being in the world that I'm attracted to. You know, there was, I remember hearing Balwant Rai Bhatt and hearing this kind of like devotion and commitment. And I remember thinking, I want that kind of devotion and commitment in my voice. I want to be that kind of person, you know? Mm. So, And then as you go on, and depending on who you study with and the ways in which they teach, you may find yourself really changing into a very different kind of person in the course of your musical training. Not so much that, you know, you acquire trustworthiness in your financial exchanges or something like that, although, you know, that may happen too, and there's legends about that. But the kind of virtue that's embedded in Paramparik bodies that I'm interested in may not stretch any further than the moment when you're singing. It may not stretch anywhere beyond your musicking body. It may not stretch to your drinking tea and chatting body. But nonetheless, it's something that's so legible and so important for so many singers and so many connoisseurs of music.
And so this is connecting to this your final some of the questions you raised at the end about the connections between ethics, gesture, and voice. So when you talk about ethics, I think you're writing about the ethical implications of bodily actions.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, this much is nothing terribly new. I mean, if you read Aristotle's ethics or, you know, the Nasirian ethics, you find this great emphasis on habit formation. You know, where do virtues come from? They come from carefully building habit over time. Uh-huh. And there's a very old tradition of thinking about ethics, both in the Islamic world and in Europe, where ethics is principally a matter of doing the right thing so many times that it becomes second nature. This was stressed a little bit less, I think, by Enlightenment philosophers of ethics, particularly Kant, who focused instead on the processes of deciding what the right or wrong course of action is. But in recent years, anthropologists have kind of revived this as a key sense of what virtue is. Virtue is something you're doing, and if you're doing it, you're doing it physically. When you're making a decision to do something, or when you're doing something out of good, well-established habit, you're doing it because it's something that's been physically trained into you. So there's actually a fairly well-established theoretical language for this much. You know, when you look at things from this point of view, there's really no great stretch in seeing, for example, or hearing an open voice, with an open hand and a tongue that's pulled down out of the way and a jaw that's wide open, as hearing this as the embodiment of a particular kind of honesty. And in fact, if you listen closely and if you perform this enough, it begins to be honesty itself, in a sense. Like this is when people speak about kula avaz, about open voice, from the point of view of virtue. It's don't hide your voice. You know, don't try to conceal the defects of your voice. You know, let your voice be open and plain and straightforward and sincere. The difference between the sort of like floating abstract metaphysical virtues and the very concrete kind of fleshy things that you do every day when you're sitting down to practice and sing start to look like they might be of the same substance. It starts to seem as though sitting down and making music in a particular way, sitting down and singing in a particular way, and moving and doing all the things physically that you need to do in order to sing, that starts to appear as a manifestation of virtue. Mm. And I think this is in large part why people become really, really absorbed with Hindustani music. And I think this, it also provides an easy kind of segue or an easy sort of bridge into speaking about some of the spiritual concerns that people come to have with Hindustani music. And it's not just Hindustani music. You know, this is people hear virtue in John Coltrane's playing. You know, people hear virtue even in, you know, the sort of musical gestures prescribed by composers. There's ways in which you come to feel like you know what Gesualdo was trying to do with those vocal gestures when you sing one of his madrigals. You know, certainly if you read African Rhythm and African Sensibility, John Miller Chernoff's book, this is shot through with all kinds of ethical readings of what it means to be an African musician. It means being a certain kind of person. It doesn't mean playing a certain set of notes. So again, this is, for me, one of the most compelling ideas in the book, and it's driving my next research project, which is about ways of cultivating vocal virtue, where I'm going to, as far as possible, be trying to figure out some of the differences between traditions of voice production that have kind of virtuous implications. So, you know, it's a very exciting thing for me, but it's also not a terribly radical thing. This is a well-established tradition in philosophy and ethnography.
Well, Matt, it's been terrific talking with you about your book, Music King Bodies, Gesture and Voice in Hindustani Music. And you answered my last question. I was going to say, what now that the book is out, what is next for you? And your project sounds very exciting. And I would like to thank our listeners for joining us today. And I would like to thank Matt Rahim for talking to us about his fascinating book, Music King Bodies, Gesture and Voice in Hindustani Music.
Thank you, Garrett. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Matt. And you've been listening to New Books in World Music. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.